Okay, so I'm here with Percival Everett, who is most recently the author of I Am Not Sidney Poitier. Percival, how are you doing?
Fine, thank you for having me.
I should point out that I've written an unpublished novel called I Am Not Percival Everett, but let's talk about yours, which is probably better.
You're just bragging.
No, I'm not. Actually, I should probably start off, because you use so many opportunities in this book to make jokes about the character's name. And I wanted to ask you, I mean, it's, you know, what is your comedic roots in terms of, like, what did you read or listen to be so obsessed? Because there's so many jokes in relation to both, you know, not Sidney Poitier, but also a number of internal metaphors, like, and puns throughout this book that I just absolutely loved. And I'm always been curious. It's in all of your work, how what you listen to and what you wrote about to get this kind of, you know, obsession with language and this obsession with puns. Like, for example, there's, you know, my name is Jeremiah Cheeseburger, and I'm a man of the cloth. I mean, very funny stuff. So how did this come about? What happened here?
I love names. In fact, I'll have to tell you the best name that I now know. I don't know if I should tell you this, though, because this name does exist in the world. I don't know this person.
Yeah.
But I had a friend who encountered this name. L-E hyphen A. Now, how would you pronounce that?
Leia or something.
Ladasha.
Uh-huh.
It's genius.
Yeah.
I absolutely love it.
Yeah.
Though I prefer the pronunciation La Hyphena.
Yeah.
But the name thing, I'm just fascinated by, what would you call it in philosophy, rigid designators.
Yeah.
What makes a name a name? What's the name of a name? What we do when we name something? Identity.
Literal misunderstandings, then.
Literal misunderstandings, yeah. Desired misunderstandings.
Yeah, yeah. So I would say, you'd say half of your creative process is literally a literal misunderstanding.
Most of my creative process is a literal misunderstanding. I just love the fact that not only can we mean stuff, but that we can mean something that we don't intend.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the case of this, actually, since you are drawing from many real-life figures, Ted Turner, of course, Sidney Poitier.
Is there really a Ted Turner?
Well, I'm going to get into this. That's part of the question. But also even the very funny riff on the Bill Cosby speech. And I'm curious, I actually should point out that I recently read Richard Powers' forthcoming novel, Generosity, which deals with the notion of what a novel really is and what ideas and characters really are. And I'm very curious to put this question to you. I mean, to what degree do you need reality to start from, and to what degree do you feel the need to be faithful to reality, or even faithful to real-life figures, or can you accept a Percival Everett figure in this who also happens to have a book called Erasure?
First, I owe nothing to reality, but of course, for any novel to work, in spite of my disregard and maybe even disdain for facts, truth is important. If it's not true, you can't stay with it. You won't believe it, and there is no work.
Yeah.
But truth has nothing to do with reality or facts.
Yeah. But you do have names to draw from, not just in this book, but also in your previous books. You know, Thomas Jefferson, Strom Thurmond. You're a guy who likes real names like this. And so I have to ask, is it just a constant influx of information from newspapers that is your creative muse? Or where do you stop from reality and start with the inventive process or the misunderstandings we're talking about?
Well, it depends on the work, obviously.
Yeah.
But I read all the time, so it just depends on what comes to me. Some figures just present themselves as too alluring to ignore. I mean, how could I go through my life and not at some point address Strom Thurmond?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure. But I mean, it can't just be just a simple impulse, because obviously
Why
you
not?
Have to. Because I'm thinking, you know, when you set out to write a novel, and I'm not you, obviously, but when you set out to find a concept or put your finger on something, is it a matter of kind of instinctively knowing that that's something to riff on or something to expand further? Or is it a matter of just, do you have any plan like this?
Sometimes I don't have a plan. Sometimes it's hit and miss, trial and error. Feast or famine.
Yeah.
All of those those duels. I don't know. For me, the way novels come is magic, and I only question it so much.
Magic. Magic through pure work? You're a prolific guy.
Yeah, I suppose. It won't get done unless I do it. So I try to do it. And I don't stress.
You don't stress? Never stressed at all?
Try not to be. There's no reason to get upset about anything, especially work.
Yeah.
And then it happens. And the more it happens, the less stress I become.
I noted in an interview that you had, that Robert Birnbaum interviewed you, and you said to him that you don't pay attention to the business of the publishing industry in that at all, that you just essentially write in this almost insulated vacuum. And I'm curious if you feel that your art is possibly truer by keeping yourself insulated from any kind of obligation to sell or obligation to top another book or to improve upon another book. What is your relationship to your own work that would cause you to keep going if you feel no stress? Or if does this no stress scenario come from just complete prolificity here and complete work ethic?
I make books. I don't understand business. I don't care about business. I don't make a lot of money, but I make enough money that I'm happy. I make enough money that I can make the next book.
Yeah.
And that's all I want to do is make art, as long as I can do it.
Yeah. But in terms of readership, do you care about the reader at all? Or?
No.
Yeah.
I can't please everyone, obviously. I've written books about literary theory and deconstruction and Dionysus. I'm obviously not a guy with my thumb on the pulse of American popular culture. So
yeah.
it's what am I supposed to do? I don't write commercial successes. And if I could, you would see one on the shelf tomorrow. But I have no interest in it.
But you are entertaining in the prose, as we sort of suggested earlier, with these names and with these literal misunderstandings and with the puns and the poetry, which is, I would argue, more comedic than dramatic, I would say. So as such, there is at least some impulse to entertain. So where does that impulse come from? Is it just come from just the no stress, I'll just go ahead and...
Well, I like to play, and I find the world and the work amusing. And I would love to think that if any reader came to my work, if one ventured into the world of Dionysus that I've created, that it would in fact be funny for any reader, in some way. In the same way, I have a novel, The Water Cure, that I'm told has funny places, but for me it's just terribly depressing.
Yeah.
So
it seems to me that the amount of funny that a reader may attach to one of your books has no bearing to your own particular personal feelings. Wherefore, then, does the prism exist? Because if the prism... If we understand a book to essentially be a prism between author and reader,
yeah.
What is the nature of your communication through that prism? Is it just the book? Or
the language is fantastic. I mean, if you find a note in the gutter, it can mean something to you, and it could have been nonsense to the person who wrote it.
Yes.
Once I let a book go, I have to let it go. I can't control what it does. I can't control what it means. I might have some intentions, but really, who gives a damn about what I meant? I can't affect it in any way. That's the beauty of doing this.
Yeah.
That's why I do it. That's the exciting part of making a novel, is that I have no idea what it's going to mean. I can entertain moments of vanity when I'm writing it, saying, "Wait, this is not exactly what I mean," and of course I have to do that to create a whole work. But at the end of the process, I'm the mother bear kicking the cub out of the den and saying, "You have to go find your own food."
Do you even want to know what it means?
Oh, I love hearing what other people find in it. They often tell me more than I understand what the work means, and I always take credit for it.
But if people are imparting their own particular meaning, I mean, have you ever had a scenario in which you've heard someone's explanation, I'm sure, and said, how could you possibly come up with this? Because that's clearly not what I intended. Or have you essentially divorced yourself of the notion of author intention entirely?
Well, I think I might have the words that you just supplied to me, but a kind of a different inflection. Mine is, wow, how did you come up with that? And I really am thrilled that they did. I've never dismayed by it.
Yeah.
Just always somewhat amazed by it.
Yeah.
And in a good way. Even if it's really far afield, and even if it makes me look like an ass, it's interesting.
Yeah. But this element of surprise that comes with reader response, so to speak, I'm curious how you keep yourself in a state of constant surprise. I'm also curious about these false starts that you had alluded to earlier, and how it ties into this expectation within yourself, or possibly the reader, or maybe we can just keep it on you.
Well, the book's not all that important, you know. It's what the book does.
Yeah.
and what meaning gets made out of it, and that's what I'm interested in. I really have very little affection for a book once I'm done with it. I love the process. I think I know something when I start a work, and then by the end of it, I realize, well, I didn't know much at all. And after this many books, I know a lot less than anybody I know. And at least my friends tell me.
Well, to what degree, I mean, do you try to become better with each book, or do you even care about becoming better? It's just simply an act for you.
Well, I do try to become better. I can't articulate what that comes to a lot. I try to become smarter about my play with language, and that doesn't mean more pyrotechnics. Often that means a novel like my novel Wounded, where I found myself writing what I consider one of my more experimental novels, though everyone thinks it's really mimetic, a really realistic text, and to me it's about as strange as, or stranger than anything I've written.
This actually leads me to ask you also about, in this book in particular, but it's in many of your other books, there's this tendency to have extremely outlandish, gargantuan figures, such as everybody in Peckerwood County seems to come across as these extraordinarily one-dimensional characters. And yet, at the same time, you do have, with the Cheeseboro scenario that I had mentioned, there are a lot of embedded metaphor, or rather more subdued metaphor within the actual sentence itself. And I'm curious how you wrangle both of these forms of description and metaphor, the outlandish that's there in the situation versus the subtleties of the actual sentence, and sometimes, you know, the subtlety of the actual decor and the landscape and all that. Do you have any sort of, ground rules that you've set to kind of establish how much something will be heightened versus how subdued it might be in the actual, on a basic sentence level?
Well, I have to say, right, there are no rules. I don't believe in any rules when it comes to fiction. If I can make you believe it, then it's fair game. Probably when I'm working, if I can make myself believe it, then it's fair game, because I don't know what you're going to believe. And it depends on the work. A novel like Not Sydney, where much of it is more a novel of ideas, the narrator is this of a certain sort, can make sort of bizarre perceptions or representations of the world and have the one-dimensional county of Peckerwood County.
Sure.
Whereas in other works, that simply wouldn't work. So the work talks to me. I the most important part of the story is a story, and I can't impose my feelings or my desire to write a certain kind of thing that day on it.
Yeah, but in identifying Not Sydney as a novel of ideas, I would argue, and this is when we get into needless taxonomic arguments, but I should point out that you are essentially sort of saying, well, this is a novel of ideas, and maybe the story itself will matter on some basic entertainment level.
Oh, no, the story still matters.
Yeah. Okay. But I'm curious how committed you are to this idea of the novel of ideas, if it's entirely a construct. Should we believe in it entirely, or should we believe in the ideas?
Well, if I've done it right, you should believe it in entirely, and superimposed upon this is the narrator's concept of this being a story of ideas. But you can't have, and this is not a rule, but for me, I cannot have a novel where the story is secondary to anything.
Yeah.
The world has to exist, and so I have to make it, and I have to make it believable. How I do that can vary, and can come across in any different number of trajectories or strategies or whatever.
Mm-hmm. But if the world exists, does it exist through the story, or does it exist through a topography that you establish in advance, a la Nabokov?
Well, from work to work, that's going to vary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But in terms of the building of the house, surely there are some commonalities here in terms of coming up with a structure or devising where you're going to stem from. So I'm curious.
There are, but I believe these are constraints from my own experience, and there's a part of me that wants to find out if I don't have to put to dig a foundation to have a stable house.
Yeah.
So, you know, I have my graduate students come to me and ask me that if I can teach them to write a novel, and my answer is very simple: no, I cannot.
Yeah.
Because I don't know how to write a novel. I've written a lot of novels. By all evidence, I will write another novel, but every time I do it, I have no idea what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And that's probably why I will do it again. Because that's fun.
Working without a net.
It's fun not knowing how this thing is going to go up.
I'm curious if you delight in, if we're talking about the novel as a house, which possibly is too generalist an identification.
No, whether it just depends where it goes.
Well, if you establish the house so that you can actually run the ball through the house, the wrecking ball through the house. That's really, you want to, essentially, for you, artistic creation is a form of gleeful self-sabotage?
It can't be. Well, certainly, if you consider disrupting all that you know about the world, a kind of sabotage, yes.
Yeah.
And I suppose in some ways that can be. If you're walking, you know, through life and you think you understand something, and you purposely take that away, then you've sort of shaken up your worldview. And for some people, that can be a sort of sabotage. For me, I consider that a necessary component of living.
Mm-hmm. Well, the common figures and the common variables between our world and the world within your books, I'm curious if, in some sense, this world that you're talking about, this gleeful anarchy mm-hmm. that we're establishing here, whether this is your way of essentially creating an alternative to the world that we presently exist in, just for your own benefit and for the benefit of any reader who might latch upon and understand or come up with some entirely different understanding. Is this how your creative output serves or functions in any sense? Or is this something in which we're getting into this notion of what the author here gets out of it and what the reader here gets out of it. But let's talk about what the author gets out of this.
Well, first of all, I think that every one of my novels is a complete and accurate representation of the world around me. Mm-hmm. I don't believe I don't believe they're abstract at all. I think they're concrete and absolutely real. So I don't find that they're at odds in any way with how I think the world is or how anyone else thinks the world is. The only constraints that are sometimes annoying, or maybe it's just one constraint, is the fact that the world I create has to exist between the covers of the book, and so that when a reader comes to it, or even when I come to it again, I am immediately reminded of the artifice of the work, and so taken away from the fact that it is in fact a reality that is around me.
This makes me wonder how many copies of your own books you keep in the house, because they may remind you of the fact that the world stops here.
No, they're around in various languages. It uses, things to level tables and whatever. Yeah. They don't remind me much of anything. I don't have, once I'm done with them, I don't have a lot of affection for them. I love all of my children, geniuses and idiots alike, and which is a great line that comes from, I think it's Walter Van Tilburg Clark said that, and I would love to take credit for it, but it's really true. And maybe they're just reminders that I can do it, again, having some books around.
Well, also going back to this notion of the novels being sort of world building, a subject that doesn't actually get bandied about too much in literary fiction, but more so in speculative fiction, particularly in recent years, has actually become something of a controversy. But this does lead me to wonder about, how much your own particular subjective view, as represented through these characters, as represented through these perspectives, really is the world, the accurate world, the real world that you're insisting that these books are.
Yes.
Can you expand upon that, sir?
Well, necessarily. All of it is, that is necessarily true. It comes out of one consciousness, mine. I cannot be anyone else. Even were I to muster up the courage to have multiple personality disorder, it would still, the characters I would create existing in the world would come out of my subjective understanding of what those characters should be.
Then how do you subvert that subjective understanding?
You just accept that it's there.
Yeah.
And again, for me, making fun of what I think and myself is often a way of creating distance between my own concerns and petty grievances with the world or desires in it with the world I'm trying to create.
Let's go from anarchy to limitations. I'm curious if you pose any particular limitations on your writing, or you work within a particular structure in order to sort of, I guess, poke through the wall or in any sense. Or going back to this earlier question of subverting your subjective view, I'm curious if limitations work in any way along these lines, and likewise, if how you give yourself permission to, if it's all anarchy, you need some kind of wall to bust your head against. So I'm curious what that process is like for you in terms of giving yourself permission. Is it just not having any stress? I suppose your stuff is playful, but at the same time, it also can be very punchy. And so I'm not entirely certain if I completely buy your no stress viewpoint. But I do think that possibly you have, there has to be some sort of edifice to smack your head against. And so,
well, there are plenty of things that are sources of cultural, social, scientific, philosophical angst for me. There's lots of stuff that interests me, lots of stuff I'm unhappy with, lots of stuff that I want to explore. But as I say that, it's all stuff I want to do. So it's not stressful in that way. I don't know if I would call the world, my approach to the world, anarchy. There's nothing sadder than an anarchist when all structure goes away.
Yeah.
Because they have nothing to do. and anarchy itself becomes a structure of resistance. So in a way, it's self-contradictory.
Yeah.
I hesitate to adopt the anarchist model of the way I approach fiction, but I will take on the playground mentality about it. I'm tired of the swing. I'm going to go to the slide now. That's why they put it here.
Got it. A big Erector set exists at the ranch.
Exactly.
I actually wanted to ask you about something I've been wanting to ask you for a while, and that is, It's in this book again. We have Not Sidney's Obligation to Build the Church. We have, of course, Reverend Go Lightly, Jeffrey's Thanksgiving Incantations. May your stuffing be tasty.
You're going to ask me about religion, aren't you?
I am going to ask you about religion. How did you know? When you did interviews for American Desert, your novel, of course, about 27 developmentally disabled Christs running around Area 51, you insisted that you were an apath, that you don't care if there's a God or not. So, but religiosity, yet again, in this book. And so I'm curious as to what the...
It's fun. I mean, I don't care. I can't know. I don't care. I can't be any more truthful than that about that question. However, in the world, this stuff is funny. and I can't ignore it. And interesting often.
Yeah.
I mean, the idea of someone speaking in tongues to me is amazing. I don't find that particularly funny, but I am truly amazed by it. And I wonder, and I'm sure that it exists on various levels, from the faking to the hypnotic. I'm interested in that kind of... people are interesting.
Yeah. Is it possible that your attraction to religion in the form of putting religion into your narrative has much to do with the fact that this is an ideological system, or even an intricate system, that just simply is something that you have no desire to ken, and you want to sort of figure out why people are attracted moth-like to this flame? Or what's the...
Well, I wonder the same thing about psychics for horses. So yeah. You know, people hire people to come and tell them what their horses are thinking.
Yeah.
People will believe lots of things, and I'm fascinated by it.
How much do you believe in something your character may believe in the form, as you were writing about the particular character? I'm curious, because you have to adopt some form of, you have to be an actor in some sense. You have to get involved inside the character's head or inside a character's heart that can sometimes be a tricky place. So do you feel that perhaps this notion of inhabiting allows you to learn about something like religion or something like these kinds of things that make people so interested?
Certainly, I hope so. I'd be disingenuous if I didn't say that I haven't had a character who is experiencing any kind of religious fervor.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean that I won't, but my own take on the world is often shaped by my sort of raving atheist grandfather.
Yeah.
And so I accept that part of myself, and I see that it shows up in the work. Just moving through the world, I don't care much, but I haven't been able to divorce my own disinterest in life from religion, from most of my characters.
Yeah. I also wanted to ask you, laundry lists. There's a laundry list of terms: a sitting duck, a dead duck, a chump, easy pickings, a babe in the woods. We sometimes get this Percival laundry list moment, and I'm curious if it extends more from, not so much from language, but more from this notion of obsession or variables. Or why do these things... Again, it goes back also to the Thanksgiving incantation as well that we were talking about earlier. But there's often this series of words or phrases that will sometimes crop up within a particular moment. And I'm curious why that is exactly sometimes.
I wish I could tell you. You know, I'm just an old cowboy. I just write books.
Yeah.
It's language. I just like it. And if I can find a strategy that works for me, I will employ it at that particular time. Why those particular words, for some reason, or those phrases, they appeal to me and they work. So.
Yeah. You know. Well, what point? To what degree do you resist language? I'm curious. Obviously, you're a language guy, but at the same time, if you're dealing with a story doesn't always match up to language tricks or even playful sentences.
Oh, I don't believe in any kind of language tricks at all. The language is the language for the story, and anything that doesn't fit it will just be this huge. It'll be the the gorilla in the room.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just, unless I want to call attention to the language for some purpose, the language is subservient to the story.
Even so, with one moment, there's a lovely sentence. At the diner, I found Diana Frump shaking her apple rump under her white waitress dress to country music on the jukebox. Big internal rhyme there, so, you know, I must ask why that moment announces itself. Well, it's a very nice sentence, and it's a playful sentence, but you could have just had it serve the story. It calls attention to the sentence.
Well, except that she's listening to music.
That's true.
And the rhyme is one that you might find in an R&B song on the jukebox.
That's possible. However, I should also point out the old man who is tossing pieces of bone onto the wrinkled surface of a spread-out blanket. Well, wait a minute here. We've got some playfulness with the old, with the wrinkled, and the bone. So he could have thrown something else besides bone, and I think it was just a...
Except that people read bones.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I really wasn't trying to do anything terribly special with language.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, but it is bone, wrinkled, and old man. So yeah. There's a symmetry there going on.
That worked out, and to some extent, you just have to let that stuff happen organically.
If
you know, most times, if you think that you're doing that, well, if I think I'm doing it, I just stop.
Ah, okay.
But all, and it's true of all metaphor. In fact, I have a line that I have not used yet, but I use it for my students, and it is, he sat there doing nothing, just like a bad simile.
Yeah. Well, that, I mean, this is interesting then. I mean, to what extent can you be aware of, say, internal rhyme or internal metaphor cropping up? I mean, these moments slipped out, and when I read them, I was very aware of them, delightfully aware. And so prose that calls attention to itself, even on a modest level, I don't think it's necessarily all bad.
No, I don't think so. However, that would not have worked had there been a third-person narration.
That's true.
You hopefully accept the rhythm and perception and movement up through the world of this particular character, and you accept his voice.
Yeah.
There are any number of ways I could have said these things that wouldn't have been his voice that would have called attention to the language, that would have been grating on you.
Yeah. So first-person perspective gives you the liberty then to pursue such mode.
It does, but that doesn't mean that you're confined to first-person perspective to do that, again, because there are no rules. If you give me a third-person narrator that, in effect, will become a first-person narrator who's simply telling the story in third-person, because you'll be giving him agency or her agency, you can do it as well.
Well, Percival, thanks very much. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
Oh, thank you.
Great, thanks. Okay.